Hi guys, welcome to Psychic Babes. I'm your host, Kirsten Sandifer, and today I have an really exciting guest, a friend of mine, Shades. Hi Shades, how are you?
I'm doing good. How about yourself?
I'm fantastic. Thank you for asking. And we are going to talk about something very, very interesting that I know a lot of you have been emailing me about, but don't really understand. So hopefully we'll be able to clear that up. And that's Enochian magic and elementals. So Shades is pretty much the expert on this. So I defer to him with all the stuff that I try to learn about it. But I'm very new to it. How long have you been doing this, Shades?
Enochian proper, I would say I've been studying it for upwards of 7 to 8 years. Practice in general kind of took a heavy turn maybe 4 years ago. And it has become a central part of my system.
It's kind of like the PhD of magic, right? I mean, it's kind of the most difficult and the most rewarding, some say. So would you agree?
Oh, definitely. In terms of just sheer, I suppose, tangible results, as in you perform the ritual and bam, you either get a vision or you observe a change in circumstance or situation. It's definitely potent in those regards.
Yeah, I've heard that. I can't wait to get into some of your stories, but I'm going to go ahead and just for you guys that aren't familiar with Enochian magic, it's based on the writings of Dr. John Dee and Edward Kelly. And it's a system of ceremonial magic that's pretty much based on the evocation of commanding spirits. And Dee and Kelly, they got instructions from angels and they wrote them down in these journals. They also wrote down the Enochian alphabet and the table of correspondences. So this entire system of Enochian magic is pretty much can be divided into like three meta structures. And then these three sets correlate to three classic divisions of hermetic science and magic. So like the zodiacal, the planetary, and the elemental. So the distinctions between these structures to me at least is not super clear cut, but each structure within the system is connected to other parts with its own subset. But it revolves around the mythos of Enoch, the grandfather of Noah. And in the story of Enoch, there are these angels that are called watchers, and they're a race of spirits called the Nephilim. And this system of magic basically focuses on contacting these watchers. And Shades, can you kind of describe a little bit more in detail about Enochian magic and what would be the purpose of practicing it?
Well, as you brought up, it's namesake, the biblical patriarch Enoch is an interesting figure. And you can read a lot of information regarding him in Hekhalot literature, particularly his descent into, or rather his ascent into heaven that somewhat mirrors aspects of the Enochian system, particularly the scrying or projecting to the 30 Aethers. But definitely he's one to look into to get more context on the system itself. But you can find a theme within Enochian magic that's very centered on progressing upward towards whether you might call it a source or a all or God of the universe, but concentrated in a singular point. In essence, you find the theme in Enochian magic of being exalted and going higher and higher and higher.
And have you found it's changed your life for the better?
It's definitely changed my life for the better or for worse is somewhat debatable. But I don't regret any of it.
Just kidding.
Sorry, what was that?
Yeah. Oh, I said if it's just given you a different perspective on things, you know, because from my understanding, Enochian magic isn't really supposed to be used to create happiness and to get things from it. It's really an observing thing and to, you know, elevate yourself. Now, I could be wrong. I mean, but that's been my understanding.
Oh, no, you're definitely correct in that regard. It's very much an elaborate learning experience in which the practitioner, once you get past all the more magical elements at the very core of it, the practitioner is getting an elevated sense of who he or she is and how his or her place in the world and how they connect to the rest of the universe.
Wow. So do you actually get information about, you know, the end of the world and things like that? Are you allowed to see those different things from in the 30 ethers?
In terms of apocalyptic like things, in terms of apocalyptic material, a lot of the visions can get revelations tier in so far as the things you see. Personally, I find that they tend to be more contextual to the individual. I haven't really gotten any inside knowledge on whether or not the world's going to end in a nuclear holocaust or anything like that yet. But I definitely found out a lot of things about myself, and I found out a lot of information that has not been properly processed until others kind of filled in the blanks. Other people who maybe observe a behavior that came about after a certain Enochian, you know, evocation or ritual that kind of brought it into perspective that, okay, now I'm different because of this. So it's definitely a very, very elaborate learning experience.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. And a lot of people have told me as well that if you're not prepared to go, like if you're not vibrationally prepared to go to a certain ether, you won't be able to go. Like that's just how it is. And you like they know better, you know, what they let you into. And if you're not, you know, you're not really supposed to take this lightly. It's not something to be messing around with just for fun. It's something which I think all magic should be taken very seriously. But unfortunately, it's not always done that way.
But. Oh, definitely. And it's very important to kind of see the ethers themselves as initiatory experiences wherein if you're not prepared, you will kind of quite literally get tossed out. I remember I attempted to scry the highest ether, Leil, quite well before I was ready, and I got tossed out. But, well, the feeling was getting.
When you say
go ahead.
And when you say tossed out, what do you mean tossed out?
It felt quite literally like someone grabbed me by the top of my head and tossed me. And the next thing I know, I'm sitting in right where I was as I was projecting or scrying to it, rather, with a feeling of massive disorientation and a headache that lasted for about 2 days.
Oh, wow. Well, can you elaborate on the three meta structures and what they mean, like the zodiacal, the planetary, and the elemental?
Certainly.
And how those
come? Oh, yeah, certainly. At the first, you have what's possibly most well-known, the Enochian tablets, which consists, of course, of the earth, air, fire, and water tablet. Now, here there's two diverging opinions. You have the magicians who are more fond of the Golden Dawn material, wherein each element is thought to be elemental proper. So the air tablet is strictly air, the earth is strictly earth, and so on. However, John Dee in his writings kind of made it clear that the use of elements in regards to the names of the tablets are more metaphorical. He wrote that the tablets were actually concerning plant, mineral, animal, and human life. And in that context, the elements proper will be found within the human tablet.
Oh, okay.
And as far as the planetary magic goes, you have the Heptarchic kings and their princes and ministers, which is a hierarchy of angelic or spiritual and chthonic, if you want to think of in those terms. Planetary spirits that kind of hold dominion over all things relating to their particular planet. Then you have the zodiacal system, which would correspond roughly to the aethers, if in the same sense that the zodiac itself is kind of a journey of the sun through each of the fixed stars, the aethers themselves are a somewhat cyclical journey.
Well, it's interesting that you said that, because I've always thought that there was, astrology and stuff was probably the most telling as far as human, when it comes to predicting how you're going to behave about certain things. So it's interesting that, this revolves around that too, because I've always thought that when it comes to magical things, that was definitely one of the most telling things when you're doing somebody's chart. So.
Oh, definitely.
So the Enochian system is descended from the incomplete, I guess, or the lost orbital system, which involves the evocation of these numerous types of spirits from various cultures. And each chapter is dedicated, I guess, to a separate ritual for a separate culture. But overall, the main ceremony is a planetary evocation. Is that right?
Within the context of the Heptarchic kings, which... they constitute the planetary, I guess, side of things proper. You can find contextually planetary titles within the tablets themselves. For example, for each tablet, you have a set of spirits known as seniors who correspond roughly to the planets. And then, of course, you have the tablet king, which would correspond to the sun. But these aren't strictly planetary by nature. It's just more of a rough correspondence to the planets to give their position in the tablet's context.
Okay. Now, let's say I wanted to start as a complete beginner in Enochian magic. What would you advise that I do? Would I start?
First and foremost,
besides reading a whole lot of material.
Well, besides studying the material, which I think is pretty important, which just as an aside, I've noticed a lot of people have problems reading John Dee's diaries. Read a lot of Shakespeare before you try to read John Dee's diaries, and it'll be a lot easier.
That's true. Yeah, they are very difficult to read. It's not hard to read. But okay, so let's... I've gone through and I've read, most of his diaries and that stuff. So what would I start doing? I guess, what would be the first thing that, in a ritual?
Well, from there, it's important to kind of get if you haven't already, get pretty well practiced in scrying and also a type of meditative, or ritualistic meditative act that John Dee himself kind of describes it as inflaming yourself in prayer. It's kind of just you hyping yourself up in a way, you thinking about what it is that you want to do and you directing every bit of yourself mentally towards that goal. In other words, you're more or less just feeding the fires of your aspiration towards attaining that.
So would that include summoning the elementals and the elemental kings?
Oh yeah, it's kind of vital in my opinion for all Enochian workings to inflame yourself in aspiration and prayer towards it. No, and of course everybody's methods will be different. Whether it's just sitting down and you praying to whatever particular source of divinity you hold to for a time, or you just sitting there and telling yourself, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this 100 times or so. But typically you want to undertake this kind of meditative act for about 30 minutes.
Okay. And then what would you do from there? Do you do the LBRP before you start any of these rituals?
You could. I do the Star Ruby since I'm a filthy Thelemite, but it's good, of course, to get a sense of, kind of clear the space prior. This could take the form of any particular things, whether it's just you contemplating about things that have happened throughout the day and kind of resolving them to, just cleaning your temple space, any particular manner in which you blank out the space or get it cleaned and ready, so to speak, prepared.
Okay. Do you put on a robe and things like that? Because I know in, you know, John Dee's book, he talks about that. And in the beginner's book of Enochian magic, they talk about doing that too.
Yeah, this is a point. Oh, yeah.
You know, bathing yourself.
Yeah, since Enochian magic is derived from to various degrees from Solomonic magic, you still have holdovers, especially regarding the tools and all these procedures. Personally, I've always been a tad bit more informal in my clothing. Like prior to it, rituals proper, you know, I wash my hands up to the up to the elbow and meditate for a good 30 minutes and such. But when it comes to, you know, clothing in general, I found just dressing up in your Sunday best, so to speak, is sufficient. Any clothing you would deem okay. Appropriate for a formal meeting would work too. You know?
Okay. Interesting. So, let's say we've done all that. Which of the ethers would we contact first, or which of the, one of the systems would we start with?
This depends partially on kind of your point of view. There are some that are of the opinion that scrying the ethers first, because it's an initiatory experience, would yield more fruit long term and give you better preparation and an exalted state by which to work with either the Heptarchic Kings or with the Tablet Spirits. And there's others that believe that you should just dive right in with either the Tablet Spirits or the Heptarchic Kings. I'm of the opinion that you should go with the Aether Spurs, starting at the 30th one, because it runs from 30 tits, which is the closest to Earth, to number one, which is Leil, which is the highest one. But doing this will give you, like I said, a whole slew of initiatory experiences. And plus, I found it helps in general that, you know, running this gambit of aethers will increase your ability to perceive things, and it'll make you more introspective, and which yields fruit in terms of cult practices, because you understand what it is you're seeing and feeling and perceiving and so on at a better level.
So your visions become more clear and things
definitely,
like that as well.
Yeah.
Can you describe the first time you did what the 30th, what was that like? What was that experience? What did it feel like? And what did
Was at the time under the guidance of a teacher who an initiator who kind of walked me through it. And oddly enough, he didn't start me with the 30th. He started me with the 28th due to his estimation of me, which, you know, he was of the opinion to do them all, but because of the, I'd had some prior training as a means of kind of giving me a better initiatory experience, he had me start with the 28th one. But as far as the 30th one goes, it's a tad bit unique amongst all of them, in that whereas Aethers number 29 to 1 are in three parts typically, which are colloquially known as the wilderness, the city, and the palace, and they don't always take those forms, but it's kind of a rough sketch of what you'll see in those parts. Whereas Tetz, the 30th one, since it's closest to Earth, is in four parts, which kind of reflect or mirror the four cardinal directions.
Interesting. And how long do you sit there and scribe for before you see something, or before you, and what do you use to scribe? Do you just try in your mind, or do you with a ball or a mirror?
With that particular, let's see, with both Tits the first time and Baage, which was the 28th one, I scribed directly using a reflective surface, which at the time I didn't have a black mirror, so I used just a regular mirror that I'd consecrated for the purpose. Others I've used a black mirror.
Couldn't you theoretically use your phone?
Oh, yeah.
Like if you have an iPhone.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that have used their phone screen as a black mirror.
Okay.
But the length of time can change. It can run anywhere between 3 to 4 hours to 5 minutes, depending.
Wow. Do you begin to feel like exhausted afterwards after sitting for that long and experiencing that? Or is it kind of like, you know, because after I channel and stuff, I'm exhausted afterwards usually. Is it kind of like that? Or is it, do you feel like
this? Again, we're very dependent upon the aether in question. After some of them, I felt absolutely horrible. After some, I did feel more, energetic. But after all of them, I definitely did feel a sense of accomplishment and completion.
Okay. Well, so a lot of people are under this, they think that Enochian magic is dangerous. And I don't think you're going to agree, but why do you think that they say this and why, you know, where does that come from? Because I know, you know, Crowley got, you know, had a, at the end, he didn't fare so well, but you know, that I don't think that really had everything to do with it.
I think partially it's due to the potency of Enochian magic and the fact that it can and often does have a tangible real world result, which can, depending upon the magician who's employing it, be a positive or negative result for themselves personally. But another danger. What's up?
Can you give me an example of a real world, result that would happen?
Due to the amount of, for lack of a better word, I guess, energetic momentum that you're getting, especially in regards to scrying the aethers, you kind of have this constant stream of momentum shooting you towards, you know, upward towards that one pointed goal destination. And if you start stray from that, or if you kind of go against protocols insofar as the procedures that have been proven to be safe, or you can end up damaging yourself. One particular story that comes to mind is that of a magician who unfortunately passed away as a result of attempting to mix entheogens and Enochian magic. Attempting to mix entheogens or using drugs for spiritual purposes.
Oh, wow. Okay. And he
overdosed in the course of a 49 day Enochian ritual in which you scry all the aethers consecutively.
Wow. that's interesting. Some of the stuff that I've heard is more like you're contacting different demonic beings and things of that nature. Is there any truth to that? And I know there's some of them.
Yes, there's definitely within, especially the tablet hierarchy, there are cacodemons, which aren't, they're not demonic in the more popular sense of evil. They're more so just very chaotic, animalistic spirits that once you kind of let loose can have a lot of negative effects on both the environment or you personally or circumstances, because they're very, very unpredictable in terms of result.
So you really have to be ready, and you have to be congruent with your spiritual development and maturity, right? Before you start, you know, going into anything like that, because you could really do some damage to yourself and, you know, to the environment around
definitely.
You, it sounds like.
Which you can apply this in general to a lot of different fields of magic, but with Enochian magic in particular, I think it's very important to know what you're getting into, to know what you're doing, and to follow procedure, at least at first, so that you have a grasp of what it is you're working with.
Now, you you had somebody kind of walk you through that. Do you recommend other people do it that way as well? Because I know apprenticeship isn't really, I guess people don't really do that so much anymore. It's kind of a shame because I would love to do something like that. But do you recommend people have a teacher to kind of walk them through it?
It definitely helps. I understand that's not available to everyone because of the relative obscurity of Anakian practitioners, for one. And although the age of the internet does make this somewhat easier, the fact that there's so many people who will claim to know what they're talking about but not really know will has damaged a lot of people's practice. But it's very beneficial to have someone to assist you, if only to tell you, you know, hey, you're not doing this right, or okay, this works, but if you do it this way, it'll be a lot easier and better.
Are you open to doing apprenticeship for people if any of my listeners are interested in practicing this, or do you recommend anybody that you know is good and that's trustworthy?
I am personally, although the requirements I have are a bit extensive, I generally hand people a reading list about a half a mile long and tell them, okay, read this and then discuss it with me, and you know, then we can get to doing some work. But as far as other means of getting, you know, guidance and help and being taught, the AA, which is a organization that was founded at the turn of the 20th century, is both very good as an initiatory structure and teaching organization. It doesn't focus strictly on Anakian. It's a Thelemic organization, but because Anakian magic is very much related to and part of Thelema, it's also covered.
Okay. Do they have those kind of in every major city? Or
there are different lineages that are scattered about. The most prominent one is the Outer College, which can be contacted online. The Cancellarius, I believe, is located in London, but they will accept student applications, and after 3 months, you can take your student exam, and if you pass that, you have a year of probation in which you keep a magical journal and submit it at the end of the year. And, you know, and what's wonderful about the AA structure is you'll be assigned someone who will more or less mentor you for a while. And then once you take a initiation into a degree higher, you'll be in that position where you'll be assigned someone to kind of mentor. And it creates a strong chain of practitioners who help and assist one another in very useful ways.
Oh, I love that. What is it? Is it pretty expensive?
Oh, it's not at all. The only cost, insofar as I've encountered, is just extracurricular work, or the procurement of supplies. Unlike, you know, say the Freemasons, there's no dues or anything. It's just do the work, study, and report what progress you've made, and you'll be guided in whatever particular direction is needed to advance higher.
That's awesome. Can you just kind of tell our listeners, like, about some of the things that have changed in your life, like, since you've been doing Anakian magic and Thelema, like, you know, both actually, what are some of the benefits that you've gotten from it? And, you know, also just deepening your understanding, and just kind of give us a bit of an idea of what people can expect.
It's difficult to qualify whether this is a direct result, but in the time that I began practice, I met the love of my life and my significantly better better other half. I also went from renting a rather small home and working a job in which I was injured on a near daily basis to owning my own property and my own home and having a job that, while there's still a significant amount of risk, I get paid a lot more. I'm not trying to paint an Enochian magic as kind of a do this and your life will become all, you know, roses and chocolates or anything, but I'd say definitely that my life has improved significantly over the past few years.
And that's kind of what I want our listeners to understand, that this isn't one of those things that's like, hey, do this and, you know, money will start falling from the sky. But it is, if you are really, if you love magic and you are very interested in the practice of it and you want to know more and truly from a place of love in your heart, you know, for it, that this is kind of, this is the way to go. For me, like, that's why I've decided to start this journey, because it's the ultimate, you know. I think it's kind of there, it doesn't get, you know, any higher than this level. I mean, I'm sure it does, but, you know, for me at least.
I would agree. I'd say magic is the means by which every man and woman fulfills their will, and regardless of what their unique expression of their will is, the man or woman who's following their will has the entire universe assisting them in their life, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's so sad that more people aren't, well, I guess it's changing now, but that more people don't understand that this is real and that this is life-changing and that this can truly elevate, you know, your consciousness and change your life. I know just in the 2 short years that I've been practicing magic, my life has changed so much, and I'm much happier than, I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, not, but, it's kind of, it's a shame that you can't really talk about this with everybody, you know, and just in locker room talk, it's, you know, people will look at you kind of like you're from Mars, and it's,
yeah,
it's,
there's always, I think, going to be this division between magic and the esoteric and normal society at large, which I guess that's why they call it the occult and esoteric. Traditionally speaking, the things we study and practice were somewhat limited to a select few, you know, initiates of what a particular tradition, and that's kind of carried over into the modern era, less out of a kind of need to keep things secret and more out of a need to not be tossed into an insane asylum.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. Yeah, but I have a question. Why do you think the angels they gave Enochian magic to John Dee?
Well,
why do you
John
think
Dee himself
them?
Was a very interesting individual, and in a way, one can consider him to have been one of the early pioneers of trying to marry science and magic together. He was a brilliant mathematician, and in fact, those who are mathematically minded can find all sorts of connections between algebra and cryptography and so forth within his writings. I think in terms of being able to understand what the system is and how the system could be used, John Dee, for a man of his time, was probably uniquely prepared for it.
Well, because it's interesting how him and Edward Kelly came together, right? They're kind of an odd pairing. So maybe can you describe kind of how they came together to came
certainly,
to work together?
John Dee had used scribes before, but they'd all kind of been low quality, so to speak. He wasn't satisfied with the results. And when he took on Edward Kelly as a scribe, he noticed a jump, so to speak, in progress. As far as their relationship goes, it's a strange one, to say the least. My own personal interpretation of it is popular to, or contrary to popular belief. I believe John Dee used Kelly and not the other way around. Kelly did have the shady persona going on, and which has led a lot of people to believe that he was kind of leading John Dee on, just telling him whatever he wanted to hear. But I do personally believe that Kelly had talent as a scryer, and the visions insofar as their accuracy were pretty spot on. And I believe John Dee probably recognized Kelly's talent and exploited it as much as he could, regardless of you know, Kelly's motivations.
Okay. So where does the term, because some people, and I've seen this just written about, and I don't understand why they term it knocking
that,
sex magic. Like, where did that come
from? I would ascribe largely to good old Uncle Al, which as a, Crowley's particular methodology, he incorporated sexual aspects into a lot of different practices. Whether this was just a quirk of his personality or whether it was central to his particular methodology of magic is somewhat debatable, but I do think that the basis for it was there. And I think that his use of sexuality, if only, if nothing else is symbolic, was very apt.
Yeah, I mean, especially like making sigils and stuff, you know, using sigils and sex magic, that is a very useful way to do it. So I was wondering if it was kind of the same with how he coined it.
With the sexual aspect of a knock-in, it's more of a it's expounded upon a lot within Lon Milo Duquette's book, but it's definitely an interesting area to look into.
Okay. Check that out. Some people believe that the angels delivered a knocking magic to John Dee to bring about the apocalypse. Do you, I mean,
this,
what's your
actually,
take on that?
I believe is somewhat a product of Donald Tyson's book regarding a knocking, and it also relates to the 49-day ritual that I mentioned earlier. It's definitely an apocalyptic ritual in which the person is transformed completely. At the end of it, you, to put it somewhat poetically, you behold God in the same way Moses did, which that's a poetic and figurative way of putting it. You don't, you know, literally see a manifestation of God as a burning bush or, you know, an old man in white robes, but you kind of, you catch a glimpse of, I guess what you would call the source material for literally everything.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's quite apocalyptic, but more so on an individual level rather than a world-ending one.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting. I'm glad I asked that then, because I think a lot of people probably misinterpret that, you know, when they hear that. So that's interesting. Now, what is the Enochian language, and do you need to be adept in it in order to practice Enochian magic, or can you do the English translations?
Well, there's a lot of caveats that go with Enochian language that a lot of people aren't really familiar with. For one thing, with the Enochian script itself, it needs to be written right to left in order to be active, or I guess charged up, so to speak, and in its left to right form, which is what we see more commonly when we look at text. It's passive or inactive, so to speak. A lot of people kind of trip over the pronunciation. As far as the pronunciation goes, there's a few different ways put out there of how to pronounce certain things. I tend to favor Rigardi's method or Rigardi's manner of pronouncing it, but it's important to understand that pronunciation in the context of Enochian magic isn't 100%, you know, important, because by its nature, it's going to be it's going to be a bit impossible for humans to speak, since it's a non-human language. But what's important is the effort. Now, that's not to say that you can just pronounce, you know, like Iada, which is one epithet for the all or the highest for the Enochian, as, you know, banana. You can't, you know, you have to make a legitimate effort to pronounce it correctly.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. It's important to keep in mind then that pronunciation isn't the, you know, most important factor, as long as you're attempting to pronounce it correctly and not just, you know, mumbling gibberish.
Right. Is it similar to this light language activation people use now, like with their transmitting activations, or is it, that has nothing to do with it? Or is that, do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm somewhat familiar with the concept, and I'd say that it's potentially related. I'd be kind of hesitant to say that, yeah, it's exactly the right, you know, exactly like, but I believe there might be some parallels between it.
Well, because of the people give activations, and it sounds different when different people talk it, you know, so it's kind of like, I don't know. And it's interesting nevertheless. Okay. So where would you recommend, like, a beginner to this, where to start? Probably with what to read first off, and then going from there.
Well, if you're a complete beginner, there's three things you definitely need to do. One is, you know, aside from reading John Dee's work, which is kind of, you know, goes without saying, you should also check out the work of Benjamin Rowe. I believe he's done more to make Enochian magic easier and accessible to anyone and everyone who's interested than anyone else alive, particularly his Enochian reference guide is very useful, because it explains the three systems within Enochian magic very briefly and simply. I would also recommend Aaron Leach's work on Enochian magic, and I believe Frater Witt is wrote the book of regarding his own initiatory experiences is another interesting read. So that's the basic reading list. The another kind of ask
is that kind of the
oh go ahead
that you require before you'll work with somebody? Is that the kind of the reading list that you require before you'll work with somebody?
Oh, definitely. Regarding Enochian magic, I don't want to kind of throw shade on Donald Tyson and his work, because he's wrote a lot of different works, but when it comes to Enochian magic, I think his work should be kind of put second to Benjamin Rowe and, of course, John Dee. And, you know, kind of the same goes for Lon Milo Duquette's work. I love good old Uncle Lon, but you should read definitely Rowe first and Leach first, then read Tyson and Lon.
Okay. Yeah, I've been getting into a little bit of Benjamin Rowe, and it's a tough read for me. So it's kind of like I have to read it over and over and over again. So it's one of those things, like, I'm so interested in this, so I'm really trying to absorb it, but it is very difficult. I think if you're not used to, you know, the language and stuff,
definitely,
it's a different experience. So you've performed all of the 30 ethers, all of the rituals for those?
As far as the 30 ethers go,
and do you recommend?
Up your spit.
I was saying, and you do recommend that people do it in a certain amount of time. Is that what you're saying earlier?
Definitely, I would recommend trying to do them first as your intro into Enochian magic. It's kind of important to remember too, and mm-hmm. think a lot of people don't realize it, that you can visit the Aethers multiple times. In fact, I know some magicians that kind of feel that if you don't kind of experience everything within the Aether, get the fullness of the experience, that you absolutely should visit them multiple times. And I'm kind of in agreement with that.
And how do the elementals play into this? Are they part of this, or is that just the beginning of kind of summoning the elementals and working with the Nakian magic?
Well, within the tablet, there's actually kind of a twofold system here, or twofold aspect to the tablets. You do have elementals, but these are kind of a protective filter, so to speak, or at least they act as a protective filter for some people who try to evoke the tablet spirits without really knowing what they're doing. So they basically get an elemental of the sort that'll show up and potentially lead them off in one direction or another. Nothing usually dangerous. The point of them in the context of the tablet, sorry, to neutralize a threat,
okay,
more or less.
Make sure you belong there, kind of.
Oh, yeah.
Type situation.
They more or less kind of act as a means of filtering out the people that are actually really trying, you know, and the ones who are good enough at magic to get a result, but not good enough to kind of discern what it is they're doing. And for the most part, they're harmless. They'll show up and usually just tell people, okay, yeah, mm-hmm. you shouldn't be doing this, or okay, yeah, you could be doing this, but how about you go do this? The elementals proper, as I mentioned earlier, are to be found within the fire tablet, so-called, or the human tablet of the four tablets, and they can also kind of be reflected in a higher state within the tablet of union, or the black cross, which is the fifth kind of tablet that connects them all together. It's somewhat different from the other four tablets in that the amount of letters is smaller, and these can be considered elemental in the sense that they're the purified form or the cosmic form of it. And so that would be the elemental work proper, in my opinion.
Oh, okay. In any of the ethers, would you say that any of them are particularly dangerous, or that there's tricksters, and that it was particularly scary an experience for you? Any of them that stand out to you?
Yes, the 28th aether, which is the aether of doubt. All the aethers are somewhat, the aethers are somewhat thematic. They all tie together very nicely, but looking at them on an individual basis, they all kind of have a singular theme. The 28th aether, or the aether of doubt, can be somewhat difficult, especially for those who are just beginning Anakian magic. There's a particular spirit there who embodies your own personal fears and doubts and such that will attempt to prevent progress within that aether. So that's a bit of an early bump in the road, but by far the most dangerous in terms of which is a good way to dissuade, other magicians, or maybe, keep them off track until they're better and are able to initiate more fully. But by far the most dangerous aether is the 10th Zouts, which is the abyss and the dwelling place of Kuronzom, who is the embodiment of delusion. It's the god that laughs. It's the demon of madness, who is all the worst aspects of the ego, all the myriad illusionary forms that will attempt to trick you, or to lead you astray, or to basically halt all progress in terms of magic and in terms of life. This is a very, very crucial moment for a magician when they're in the 10th Aether or when they're in the Abyss, because crossing the Abyss is a very high benchmark for magical development, but it's also a somewhat testy. It's definitely a test for a magician, and it can lead to a lot of different consequences depending upon whether or not they can slay Kalanzon, so to put it metaphorically, or whether, you know, they have to stop and wait until they get more.
There's an
anecdotal story of how Crowley, when he was in the desert with his own scryer, because he was trying to kind of emulate John Dee, they did the 10th Aether, and Crowley lost his mind temporarily and tried to bite his scryer to death. So there's that to consider. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Wow. What did you experience, if you don't mind? What was the hardest thing you experienced?
Keeping silence, because silence is the key to making it through that aether. You have, or at least for me personally, I had every form I can imagine in terms of possibility kind of hit me all throughout that entire day, because for me that was a day-long experience that it took the form of everything from my desires to my fears to anything that I could contemplate. Basically, the what if that will drive a person insane. That's what I dealt with.
Wow. Is it your experience a lot of people don't make it through this the first time?
Yes and no. I think people who go into the 10th Aether usually by that time are pretty well experienced. So they know enough to start seeing the signs of, okay, I'm not going to make it through this, so I'm going to back off for now and then hit it again once I've got, a little bit more introspection and more, experience under my belt. But the key which allows anyone to pass through this aether is just silence. It's just observing everything you see and accepting it and not attaching any importance to it.
Oh, yes. I mean, sounds easy enough, but yeah, I'm sure. I mean, losing ego is that was definitely a struggle for me, when I was going through my awakening. It was something I struggled with back and forth, because it was I'm not ready to let go of some of these things. And then, then you are, and you can't deal with things. So it's a back and forth thing, but I can imagine this is a lot tougher, but sounds very cathartic and very amazing. Probably feels like you've accomplished a whole lot.
Oh yeah, it's an experience.
I was going to kind of just touch again on how one would start one of these rituals, and a book, a certain book that you get the keys out of?
Well, the keys,
where does one get those?
The keys themselves,
for the different
ages. To kind of give a brief explanation, there's 19. The first 18 are conjurations or invocations that are particular to parts of the tablet. And the first key itself is kind of like a general invocation. So usage of the first key is a bit more generic and widespread. For example, I often tell people that the first key itself can be used in banishing, not so much because it gets rid of negative things around you, but because it basically invokes better things. But the key that's used in the scrying or projecting of the aethers is the 19th key. And it's the same for every aether. You just alter the name of the aether. So if you were trying to scry or project to the 30th one, Tetz, you would, put Tetz in and so on and so forth for each Aether. The key itself remains the same. It's just you're using a different name within the key each time for whatever particular Aether you're going to.
Okay, gotcha. Well, and it sounds like this is pretty, like, especially some of the different ethers are pretty involved. So you wouldn't want to have, like, kids around the house when you're doing performing.
Yeah, especially because rituals, you don't really know when it will end. And there's another factor that it can be summed up in the it can be summed up by putting it like this. Once you begin scrying or projecting to the Aethers, you're effectively, in a sense, evoking the Aethers. And this can have noticeable effects both internally and also externally. You know, it's always possible you might do a scrying session of an Aether and then end it. And then 20 or 30 minutes later in Walmart, just suddenly start seeing spirits that you were interacting with, you know, earlier going down aisles. You know, that's not super common, but it's very important to note that if you are in fact evoking these Aethers, you can't really banish them, so to speak. You know, the experience is going to be with you, and that experience may be ongoing, or it might just be limited to one scarring session. It's somewhat unpredictable. It's somewhat trippy to, you know, think you, okay, somewhat trippy to think, okay, yeah, that was fun, but I'm done scrying, so now I'm going to go to work. And then as you're driving down a very busy street, suddenly everything kind of gets blurry, and the cars around you are no longer cars. They're, you know, motes of light that have grown and are shrinking in size, and the skies turn from blue to purple, and all kinds of crazy things can happen.
Oh, wow. One last question kind of on this. Now, Anakian magic, I know it doesn't really deal with extraterrestrial beings per se, but have you gotten any information about that? Or do you know? Are you made privy to any of the knowledge about other civilizations?
That's actually a very interesting concept. Due to the sheer just strangeness of these entities, it would almost be accurate to say that they're aliens in of themselves. Mm-hmm. Maybe not aliens in the traditional sense of dwelling in another planet within our galaxy, but aliens, I suppose, in the more extra-dimensional sense of the word, because these are very strange and abstract creatures.
Right. Kind of like law of what, you know, you've probably read the law of one, like that kind of, is that the kind of experience?
Yeah, you'll see spirits that might have an appearance that would be so alien in nature that you can't comprehend it at first from looking at it. There's some spirits that are actually very reminiscent to the writings of H.P. Lovecraft, which has led some people to conclude that Lovecraft in magic itself might be a sort of extension to Enochian magic. I haven't seen any proof that H.P. Lovecraft was aware of Enochian magic, and I know it's been professed that he was an atheist, but it wouldn't surprise me to find out that he was aware of it, because a lot of what he wrote is reminiscent to some of the things I've seen.
Very interesting. Well, this has been a fantastic episode. I'm so excited to get going on studying this more now, and I hope my readers will feel this, or my listeners will feel the same way. And listen, thank you so much again for coming on here, and
Not a problem. I really appreciate it. Having me.
It's been really interesting.
You too.
All right. Have a good evening. Bye. All right. Bye-bye.